Bevor es losgeht mit der Episode, noch ein ganz, ganz wichtiger Hinweis. Wie ihr wisst, das AHA-Programm ist draußen und Tickets gibt es auch noch welche. Wer also noch ein Weihnachtsgeschenk braucht, klickt den Ticket-Link in den Shownotes und packt die ausgedruckten Tickets unter den Weihnachtsbaum.
Most important for our story, Freud thought that our personalities and our personality structure was done by the time we were 5. And though we don't think that now, and we think, oh, parenting is the key thing. It's not. It's one thing. It's one thing amongst many. Okay, so why then, if this is the data, is the cultural narrative and the relative perspective so strong that we really are recapitulations of ourselves when we were kids? I'm going to give you 6 reasons for why I think that's the case that have to do with what I think of as fundamental features of human nature that guide the way we perceive the world.
Es ist eine Binsenweisheit. Menschen entwickeln sich unterschiedlich. Der eine hört ein Leben lang am liebsten Bruce Springsteen, eine andere trägt jedes Jahr ihre alten Platten auf den Flohmarkt. Die eine geht auch noch mit 50 mit ihren Schulfreundinnen in die Skiferien, der andere wechselt alle paar Jahre seinen Freundeskreis. Aber warum verändern sich die einen, während die anderen sich selber bleiben? Und was passiert, wenn ein Kind erwachsen wird? Brent Roberts ist Psychologe an der University of Illinois. Im Januar 2025 hat er am AHA-Festival darüber gesprochen, wie wir geworden sind, wer wir sind. Viel Spaß mit dieser Lecture.
Vielen Dank. Ich spreche nur ein bisschen Deutsch. Das ist alles. Guten Tag. Ich werde sprechen Englisch. Damals, ich werde sprechen Englisch, ja? Okay. I'll speak English now. Because you're very kind. When I usually try to speak German in Germany, they tend to not like what I do. As you know, they don't like their language taking liberties with. So the title of the talk, of course, in German is Bin ich noch die gleiche Person, die ich als Kind war. And I want to thank Christoph and the organizers for the opportunity to talk to you about this. Because when he sent me the question, I thought to myself, as somebody who does research and has done research in this space for several decades, 3 or 4 to be exact, that I didn't know the answer to the question as well as I would like to know. And I wanted to know the answer to the question. And I thought it would be fun, of course, to take a little time and dive into the data and look and see what answer I could come up with. So in English, of course, am I the same person as I was when I was a child? Who am I? I couldn't understand what Christoph said about me. Comprehension is definitely not there. I'm a professor of psychology. I've been a professor since 1994. I'm a personality psychologist by training, so my area of expertise is trying to understand why you're different than the person you're sitting next to, and why, if I bothered to talk to each of you, which would be a wonderful thing to do, your stories would all be unique. So the personality psychologist wants to understand how people are different, how they're the same, and where that comes from. Where did you get your personality from? I always pose this question to my undergraduates, how did you arrive at adulthood with the personality that you have? Because you possess one, we know that, and it has a tremendous influence over who you are and how you think about the world. And so it's one of the questions that drive our work. I am at the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. It is not Chicago. We wish it was Chicago. I honestly don't think there's a rural area in Switzerland that's equivalent to how rural Urbana-Champaign. Just imagine a cornfield with no mountains and a university's place somewhere in the middle of that. And you'll know why we volunteer every time somebody invites us to Switzerland. Not a mystery, trust me. it's really bad. We were like, we'd like to retire someplace. And it's like, well, Switzerland, you know, because there's no place in America like your place. I also have an affiliation with the University of Tübingen, just north of here, with an education group where we do a lot of similar work. So we are familiar with this. And this is why I try to speak German, have for the last 12 years, and I'm still failing. I study personality development. So the area of research that I look at in particular asks the question, how do you get your personality over time? We all possess these differences from each other. And the real question for me is, how did you get there and what's going to happen to you? Does the person you marry affect the way you change over time? The career that you chose, as I like to tell people, is you spend at least 40 hours a week, unless you've cut your week back, working on something that you may or may not love. Does that leave an indelible trace on who you are? These are the kinds of questions that we address in my lab with my collaborators and my students. We do a lot of what we call longitudinal research, and that means we are we're either very patient people or we like to exploit the hard work of other people. For example, there's a longitudinal study out of Zurich that somebody started in the 1970s, and we found it. And it was like, ooh, we can do research on this because it had the necessary ingredients for us to ask the question, how did you change over time? You have to track people for a long period of time to do our research, to really understand the answer to the question. And so we do a lot of research where we do that. We ask you questions, we observe you, and then we go away, you forget about us, and then in a few years we call you back and say, hey, would you care to answer those questions again? To which many of our participants say, who are you? Because, which would be a theme here, they've forgotten who we were. But this is the type of work that we do and why I think in this case I was interested in the question that was posed. Okay, I got that. So these are some of the examples of the studies we do, 16 going on 66, so followed a group of people from the US for 50 years. This started before I was born, so I can't say I can take credit for it, but nonetheless, that's the type of thing we do. In a research study from Luxembourg, we asked questions like whether the differences between kids at age 11 predicted things that happened 30 or 40 years later. And then a theme for our work is what we call meta-analyses, where we go in and we aggregate or bring together other people's hard labor, and then ask the question at a global level, what kind of picture do we see? For this talk, I've done something like that to give you a good overview of an answer to the question about whether you're the same as when you were a child. Okay, so back to our question. Are we the same as we were when we were children? I wanted to start with some allusions to the fact that this is an idea that's steeped in our culture, in Western culture especially. And so this is William Wordsworth, who wrote this relatively famous poem. My heart leaps up when I behold a rainbow in the sky. So was it when my life began. So is it now I am a man. So be it when I shall grow old or let me die. The child is father of the man. So what he's alluding to, of course, is the joy that you get when you see a beautiful rainbow. I had an experience of coming off of Mount Rigi a few years back, riding the boat into a storm with a beautiful rainbow over your city. It was awesome. What Wordsworth is alluding to is that he could remember when he was a child seeing his first rainbow, and the joy and the awe that he felt was the same joy and the awe he was feeling as a middle-aged man, and the hope that when he was old, he would still feel that same joy. And then, of course, the famous quote, the child is the father of the man, kind of codifies the whole idea that, well, you know, we are just recapitulations of ourselves. You build the foundation early, and you can see that structure as people grow old. There are, of course, other literature and cultural icons. Pip is a character in the Charles Dickens book, Great Expectations. If you're not familiar with the story, he's a fine, young, poor lad, perfect Dickens character. Put upon by his sister, relatively destitute, in a very compelling situation, helps a criminal out in a very kind of moral and ethic and kind way, who was in need, needed food and help. And he helped them and didn't turn him in and treated him well. Long story short, when he's older, rich, affluent, gets confronted with the fact that this is his patron, is asked to help the criminal out again, and just as he did when he was a child, he does, because it's the right thing to do. And again, even though he's gone through all these changes, he's still that kind child he was as a young man. We know, of course, Harry Potter, who was donated a piece of his personality very early in an unwanted situation where an evil guy said, die, and the whole series is based on the idea of him wrestling with the existence of this little morsel of evil somewhere in his psyche. So even modern individuals who might not have read those classics or those poems have the same idea being inculcated. And then there's Aunt Susie. I'm sure all of you just had your vacations and your holidays. We had ours, and as you know, with most holidays, you get to visit with family. And we were visiting with family, and you, all the awkwardness that happens with that. And one of our aunts was conversing with us, and she asked, oh, what are you doing in the coming semester? Are you traveling? And we said, yeah, we're going to go to Switzerland. Oh, what are you going to do? Oh, we get to give a talk at this festival called the AHA Festival. She says, what are you talking about? I said, well, I'm trying to answer the question, you know, are you the same as you were when you were a child? And without missing a beat, of course you are, is what she said. And as a person whose job it is to lecture, I felt wronged. Because she said it in such a way that it was clearly obvious I was not to elaborate. And she was very confident in her answer. It was like, of course you are. And what's for dessert? You know, there was severe lack of curiosity. I'm sure you've never had that experience at your family gatherings over the holidays. So this idea that we are the same as we were when we were young is a pervasive one in our cultural narrative. Why might we agree with Aunt Susie based on a more psychological take on things or a research-oriented take? Well, there are a number of reasons I think that my field of research is responsible for also. Part of which is our legacy. This is that gentleman by the name of Sigmund Freud, who is, whether we like it or not, kind of the harbinger or creator of the field of psychology. He had very, very provocative, very colorful ideas, most of which we don't pay attention to now. But when it came to our personalities, he had a very strong theory that what happens to us very early is the most important thing for our personality, in particular things like potty training and resolving the Oedipal complex were thought by Freud and Freudians to be the ultimate way, the crucible in which your personality is created. Negotiating your problematic desires when it comes to your mother and resolving those with your father and resolving the Oedipal complex would make your personality what it was. Certain politicians come to mind in the US who maybe didn't resolve that. But I will not speak their name here. Most important for our story, Freud thought that our personalities and our personality structure was done by the time we were five. And though we don't think that now, we have kind of a Freudian hangover when it comes to studying development, so to speak. Because if you look at, for example, developmental science, for the most part, it focuses on 0 to 12. Nothing important happens to you after 12. I don't think there's anybody here who's younger than that, right? And so, sorry to break this to you all, but according to developmental science, you're done. I'm here to tell you that's not the case. But nonetheless, that kind of perspective where we need to focus on childhood exclusively kind of recreates and supports this cultural narrative that the most important place and time for our lives, for understanding where our personality comes from, is childhood. Of course, in modern parlance, there's even, this is one of the more popular books in the US right now, The Body Keeps the Score, which is kind of one of the core texts on trauma and trauma therapy. This poses that even though you might not remember it, if you experience the trauma, whether psychological or physical, it's stored in you. Again, this kind of idea that the things that happen to us that create who we are stick with us regardless, okay? So there's a cultural and scientific, let's say, umwelt around this idea and reinforces our aunts. What does the data tell in terms of a story? That's what I'm here to tell you. I'm going to do a little work to get us there, for which I'll apologize. There will be some numbers. try to make them kind. Okay. The interesting thing about this question and why it was very interesting to me is we need really particular data that is highly unusual and, in fact, has only really come about in the last decade or so. because it's kind of an esoteric question and one that's difficult to do and not one that's of prime interest to funding agencies. It has to start with the assessment of children. That's a given, right? It has to follow them for a long time, at least into adulthood. And so we're talking decades, not just a few years. Most research is not done this way. Most research, we study kids, look at them for a year, whatever it might be. Same with adults. We don't usually track things out over time. It has to measure things similarly in childhood and adulthood. These, in scientific parlance, these are completely different tribes of researchers. So it's not common for the people who study children to work with the people who study adults. And so there's not a lot of communication until the last two decades or so. And then there was some kind of communication about what it was that was being measured. Okay. Before I proceed, let me apologize for the jargon that I use and that the field uses. So I'm going to define some terms for you. We have some terminological issues that have to do with words like temperament, which is a very common word used to describe children, personality or personality traits, which are used to describe adults, time is of essence, age, of course, is not unimportant, and sameness. Sameness is a really sticky thing that we need to spend a little time thinking about, and I'll ask your opinion on that. Okay, so temperament is defined as the constellation of inborn traits that determine a child's unique behavioral style and the way he or she experiences and reacts to the world. It is the fact that children come into the world possessing different temperaments, right? If anybody has had more than one child, you know what I'm talking about. It's the best way to immunize yourself from thinking you have any influence as a parent, have more than one. Because then you see that they really do start the world in different ways despite the fact that you're doing the same thing to them. And there's a cadre of my colleagues who study this, they call it temperament, and they study things like activity level. Some kids are energetic, some are not. Mood, some of them are happy, some of them are not. Distractible, some of them can be distracted easily, some of them ignore you altogether. Persistent, some will latch on to a goal and not give up, some don't care, right? So even kids who are very young demonstrate these types of individual differences that we care about. This is typically what we study when we're looking at young children. Personality, defined this way, the person's collection of interrelated behavioral, cognitive, and emotional patterns that comprise their unique adjustment to life. It's the same thing. the narcissism of minor differences, right? But for the most part, we're talking about the same kind of content. We're trying to figure out how people are different from each other, whether they're 3 or whether they're 23. And personality is the same. For adults, for you, we organize these dimensions usually into 5. We call them the big 5. In English, we have the OCEAN as an acronym if you would like to remember this. It helps. Openness on the high end is creativity and spontaneity and imaginativeness. On the low end, it's being concrete. Conscientiousness on the high end is demonstrating persistence and industriousness and organization. On the low end, impulsiveness and disorganization. Extroversion is marked by liking to be around people, talking, and being sociable versus being reserved and quiet. Agreeable, you're trusting, helpful, and cooperative versus being suspicious and uncooperative. Neurotic is the only negative one here. On the high end, that's being anxious and pessimistic and worried. On the low end, that's being calm. So these are five big domains. It's how we like to organize at least personality traits when it comes to adults. They are the same, as I said, as temperament. We can use work that's been done linking the two in a lot of variety of ways. We know, for example, that openness is related to being seen as an active and adaptable child. Conscientious adults are thought to be persistent and not distractible children. Extroverted adults are thought to be active and happy kids. Agreeable people are seen as having positive affect and reacting to others positively. And then neurotic adults are seen as negative and moody and sensitive as in childhood. So we've linked the two domains so we know we can communicate to one another, and then we can make a connection between these. Time is as I noted, fundamental to the question of, am I the same person? For the sake of this talk, I'm restricting myself to a relative long time. So I'm not asking whether a 5-year-old is the same as a 7-year-old or very consistent. Like, it's a kind of a short period of time. I'm really interested in longer periods of time. So I'm exclusively looking at studies that looked at 15 to 20 years of time. Just because that is, I think, what we were asking behind that question. Am I the same as I was when I was a kid? Okay, and then age, of course, comes in many different forms, babies, toddlers, children, adults. For this talk, I'm going to define childhood as 0 to 10, because that's what my developmental scientist colleagues tell me to do, and then adulthood as anything somewhere north of 17 or so. Okay. Whether or not you believe that, I understand. If you have 17-year-olds, they will be of a strong opinion that they are, but that may not be your opinion. Okay. Sameness. How do we define being the same? This is a hard question. So hard to actually posed it to my colleagues to ask them their opinion. There are lots of different ways that we've cataloged sameness in psychology. They're all statistical, they're all arcane, and they don't translate well into any language, whether or not it's English. So what I've done is I've taken those statistics and I've translated them into odds. I hope you don't mind. It's not as good as it could be, but if you've done any gambling in your life, you've all done gambling because you're alive. Whether you put a number on it is the question of interest, of course. And so I wanted to see whether it had some intuitive appeal and ask your opinion. If we assume that things are random, then of course we would say there's 50-50 odds. If what you were like as a child has absolutely nothing to do with what you are like now, then we would say you had a 50-50 chance of knowing. If you were an active, energetic kid, that you would be an extroverted adult, right? That's randomness. So then the question becomes, is 60-40 the same? You feel comfortable with saying there's a 60% chance that you would be extroverted as an adult if you were active as a child, to say that it's the same? Or 70-30, a 70% chance of being able to predict from a childhood dimension sameness? 80-20? 90-10? I'm not going to go higher. We have too much error and unreliability in psychology for me to push the limit. What do you think? Let me see a show of hands. How many of you think 60-40 is sufficient for saying you are the same? I believe that. Oh, we have some. Thank you. I always like variability. It's my job. We don't want it the same. 70-30? Okay, thank you. 80-20? Okay. 90-10. The absolutist, the hard-nosed folks. Okay. So you're somewhere in and around 70-30, 80-20, with a preponderance of you saying 80-20. Okay? You're in good company. I asked my expert colleagues the same question, and they said 80-20 also. I said, well, how do you define sameness? Give me the statistic. And I translated those into hit rates. So we're comfortable saying that if you had an 80% chance of predicting that a kid would turn into an extroverted adult, they're pretty much the same. Or reverse it, looking back, if you're extroverted, you had an 80% chance of being an active kid. So we have a standard, an agreed upon one. And I agree with this. It needs to be a substantial number and pretty high. I do like the realists on the 60-40. We'll get back to you in a second. I think there are three of you. there's some wisdom in that group. This is an example of one of the studies. This is one of my dear friends, Avshalom Kaspi, who published, this is one of the first studies to actually address this question. They looked at behavioral styles when kids were 3 and personality traits when they were 26. They looked at 3 different temperaments, so to speak, under controlled, which is the opposite of conscientiousness, and inhibited, which is the opposite of extroversion, and emotionally stable, which is the opposite of neuroticism. They measured the big 5 in adulthood, so they did our normal way of doing things. They had staff-rated temperament. It's a good study. They had a lot of money, and they had a lot of professionals doing the work, so you have really reliable measures and high-quality measures. And the adults themselves said who they were, which is sensible. We've tried to do self-reports with 3-year-olds. It gets messy. Usually just a lot of crayon on the Scantron sheet. It tends to not feed, sorry. And then temperament was rated at age 3 and personality traits at age 26. So it satisfies the criteria that I was using to try to say, okay, I want research that demonstrates this. This is a really nice example. So I also am using and will show you data from our meta-analysis. This is a meta-analysis of about 400 studies, which has parsed the rest of the life course. So you can look and see how the question is answered with different ages and different times. Okay. So what do the 8 studies that I found show? Am I the same from when I was a child? So I've broken this into 0 to 5, 5 to 10, 10 to 18, 18 to 25, 25 to 35, and 50 to 60, just for comparison purposes. Childhood is 0 to 5 and 5 to 10. And the odds of predicting that somebody had a particular personality trait in adulthood based on what we know in those 8 studies is 55%. The 3 people over here are starting to smile, nod. Same for 5 to 10. So, relatively low. We'll get back to that. Gets a little better when you get to adolescence, but not really. We just get up to 60-40 at that point. College years, a little higher, 65-35. Young adulthood, you get up to 70-30. And then when you get to 50-year-olds, some of us are like that here, if I ask you who you are now, observe you, measure it in whatever way, shape, or form, and I come back to you in 20 years, pretty good chance you're going to be the same person. Okay? So things get more stable with age. But we start out definitely a little less predictable than at least I thought. And I found this interesting and surprising. And I want to talk a little bit about that and give some explanations, I think, why. Wait, I forgot to do. Oops. Aha! Uh-huh. There we go. Sorry about that. Think things happen. Okay, what does this mean? It means we're less the same than we are different from when we were kids. Okay, so I want you to consume that, sit on that for a little bit. Right? Aunt Susie is not pleased. She is not going to ask me, trust me. My battery died, which means I'll be stuck here. Okay, so why then, if this is the data, is the cultural narrative and the relative perspective so strong that we really are recapitulations of ourselves when we were kids? I'm going to give you 6 reasons for why I think that's the case that have to do with what I think of as fundamental features of human nature that guide the way we perceive the world. So, one is that we really love confirmation bias. We have really poor memories. We're storytellers about others and ourselves, which I think is incredibly important in this case. We're really bad statisticians. I know that as somebody who teaches it. And of course, our own development gets in the way, and I'll talk a little bit about that. So what do I mean about confirmation bias? It's an incredibly robust thing. Confirmation bias is the preference for information that fits with our preconceived notions of ourselves or the world, right? And if you think about it from this perspective, you know who you are now, and if you're asked to retrospect to how you were when you were 5, you go, oh, I'm an extroverted person now, I must have been an extroverted person then. Ooh, there was that time when I was at the family reunion and I, you know, stepped out and I decided to sing cabaret. I'm an extroverted person. Subsequently forgetting all the times when you sat in the corner and didn't do that, right? So that's confirmation bias. You tend to glom on to the thing that confirms your notions now. And humans do it everywhere and in all places. It's one of the most pervasive, problematic biases that we have. And I think it's really key in this case because we're retrospecting back typically. And then we're going to carve off the disconfirming information from our experience and not acknowledge it. Our memories are less than perfect. And that's a good thing, according to my cognitive science friends. We have to forget to be able to learn new things. So this is not a bug in the system for humans. It's a feature. But it is also the case that means you and I are not Wikipedia or a digital read of something that got recorded, you know, a decade ago. We don't have perfect, well, some of you do. There are very few of us that have really good veridical memory of everything that we've gone through. I love you, you're amazing. My running partner's that way. He can tell you the lyrics from very bad 1980s punk music, verbatim. It's impressive, but it's a very uncommon gift, right? Most of us don't have that, and we have to remake things and we have to forget things to be able to make new things. And so we do forget a lot, and that's okay. In terms of personality, we even have some really fun evidence that it plays a significant role in how we reconstrue ourselves. So this is another study done by my friend Avshalom, where they assessed a number of people when they were 18 and then followed them up 10 years later. And then ask them their personality at 18, ask them their personality at 28. And then they did something interesting. They said, you're here, why don't you rate yourself on this personality inventory the way you were when you were 20? I don't know, okay. Yeah, so basically you think back, okay, I'm like this, and you rate yourself. The ratings that they made of what they thought they were like when they were 18 or 20 correlated more highly with what they were like when they were 28. So they couldn't remember what they said 10 years prior. And when they answered it, they used their current self as the guidepost for what they were. So not only is our memory imperfect, combine it with a little confirmation bias about how you are now, and you get this building perspective that you were the same over time. Storytelling, I think, is key. Humans are storytellers. Every talk I give is based on telling a story. Every lecture I give is based on telling a story. I used to think this was wrong, but now I understand it's right. It is the way humans work. Storytelling in this case has a very particular place because, like I said, three-year-olds are really bad at giving self-report personality ratings or telling us what they're like, right? For a good reason, they shouldn't be able to. So if you think about the stories that you were told about what you were like, you were most likely told these stories by somebody else, your parents, your relatives. The relatives who do the, like, I changed your diaper story, isn't that great? It's always my favorite. Right? And you're like, usually in front of your new girlfriend or boyfriend. It's really awkward. We do that to our kids now. But if you think about that, you're the audience to your own story in these kind of situations, because you weren't really there to record things when you were three. It was somebody else doing it. And so you're remembering a story that was told to you. And trust me, because I've seen myself do it, the stories get cleaner, better, funnier, right? With age, you know, we tell the same one, but a little twist to make them laugh a little more. And you know, you might make it a little more exciting, a little more interesting. So the story itself moves, the narrative moves. And so the storytelling capacity of humans, I think, is a real key feature here too. Again, making us less good at looking back and recording what we were like than we should be. We're not good statisticians. This is okay. You don't travel with a sampling frame. Sorry, I'm using terminology from my demography friends. In your head, you don't have access to 1,000 people to compare yourself to. You have access to yourself mostly, maybe a partner, maybe some kids or some brothers and sisters and family members. It's not enough data, trust me. Okay, you need a lot of data to be able to look at these things, hundreds of people at least, preferably thousands. And so you don't have a counterfactual to be able to make a determination. It's okay, but it means you probably shouldn't use that information so diligently if you do. And then age and development get in the way. This is a really obscure figure. I'll try to parse it for you. So these are plots of the continuity of personality over time, organized by different ages. So the lower one here is starting with 10-year-olds. You see it starts pretty high, plummets pretty quickly, then stabilizes. But it's lower than the other ones. You go up to 20-year-olds, it's higher. 30-year-olds, it's higher. 40-year-olds, even higher. And you march through the life course. And you see what I told you before, which is that a 50-year-old is pretty predictable. But with age and time and life, you're getting more consistent. And so if you think about the question, opposed to a 45-year-old, they're going to look back and have 10 to 15 years of meanness, sameness, to look through to get back to the 5-year-old. And that's going to bias you again. So Aunt Susie is probably the wrong person to ask. Your nieces and nephews, your sons and daughters, they're going to have more access to what it is they need when it comes to the information. So our own age and development is going to be a problem. Okay. So psychology does have some answers to the question why we might not be the same as when we were young, and I'll talk a little bit about that. First thing is that you all probably know is neoteny. Humans are born about 5 years premature, according to the evolutionary theorists, right? I mean, in the sense that a baby cannot take care of itself, it doesn't function. Other species, you know, the babies are born, a little horse comes out, and within 15 minutes, it's trotting around and eating. That would have made parenthood so much easier. Contrary to that, we had to raise them, feed them, care for them, teach them. And of course, in terms of our own development, kids don't get the full repertoire of cognitive functioning until they're 12 or so. And then culturally, we have a lot to teach ourselves, right? We have to teach all the rules of our societies and get them to understand what it is we do as individuals in this community. That takes decades, right? So there's a lot going on and it takes a long time. So it's weird to think that you would have something set in place so early. The development that happens is a result of lots of different things. There's a generalization I'll make, it could be another talk. We haven't found magic bullets, despite the fact that with the Freudian hangover, if you look at developmental science, moms, I'm sorry, you are the focus of all the research. Dads, start pulling some weight. Mostly by coming into the lab, because when we do studies and we want to understand parenting and children, moms show up, dads don't. And that's why they're the focus of all the research, because they're in the lab and you ask them questions, right? And we think, oh, parenting is the key thing. It's not. It's one thing. It's one thing amongst many. And all the things that we've studied so far have really small effects. Odds of like 55, not 80. When it comes to who we our resulting person and personality are. So we develop for a lot of reasons, for many different types of experiences, and there isn't one big thing that happens to us. There might be, of course, big things that have happened to you. I don't want to diminish the significance of those. But as a species, it seems lots of things go into making us who we are. There are developmental hills and valleys along the way that make life more interesting, especially for developmental scientists. So in particular, there's the disruption period and then the maturation period. I'll talk to you about those. So this is a really nice graph from a friend, Christopher Soto, who does research like this, where he's tracked changes in conscientiousness from age 10 through age 60 to 70. Conscientiousness being one of the big five. And the conspicuous thing that you see and what we see across all the other adult personality traits is this big divot. Age 10 is awesome. Really, it really is if you think about it, right? The end of innocence, so to speak. It's the time before adolescence when things change, right? You emerge out of your family of origin where your parents are cool. And then you suddenly look around and go, well, I need to get along with this peer group out here, and they're, you know, dangerous and unpredictable. And they may like you, they may not like you, and you plummet, right? And there's a lot of discord, a lot of uncertainty, a lot of reorganization, and it's tough. And you see this on a number of studies, and it's called the disruption period. And then you get to 15, 16, and suddenly things start taking off. And if you think about it, I'm asking a 25-year-old to think back to when they were five. This is the gulf of change that they have to look across, right? So it's not this simple thing where we just emerge in a nice linear fashion growing things. We go through a lot of weird and interesting change along the way. The same is true of adulthood. This is to contradict some of the things that my developmental scientists assume. Sorry, it's not a pretty graph, but it's functional. This is change in the big five across the life course in that aggregate study of meta-analyses based on 400 longitudinal studies. That panel is agreeableness, that's emotional stability, that's extroversion, that's conscientiousness, and that's openness to experience. Mostly what I want you to see is the scallop. Yeah. We can get to that, but this group is a little old. Might not go well. With the college students, they don't care. They laugh. They say, oh, that's my dad. But what I really want you to focus on is that early scallop that you see. That's 15 to 25, 15 to 30. And for personality traits, the most important period of growth and development isn't when you're a kid. It's when you're growing into your adult self. And at that time, you change the most. And if you think of these things as good things, the change is positive. You get nicer, you get more responsible, you get more emotionally stable. The emotional stability one is really good. You keep on getting more emotionally stable as you grow. So the future holds. Some poet has to come up with a good line for me. If you could send that to me via email, I'd appreciate it. But you see, with the exception of extroversion, in all cases, we have this maturation period from 15 to 30. And that's when the most personality trait change happens. And it's all quite positive. It doesn't happen to everybody, but it happens to most people. The structures then develop and change. And again, if I'm asking a 25, 30-year-old, look back at yourself when you're five, not only do they have to go through the disruption period, but they have to take into consideration the fact that they've actually changed a lot as young adults. And I think that makes it much less likely that you're going to be the same person when you're 25 as when you're five, because of the changes that you experience, many of them quite positive. Two big implications that I'll end with. It is very common, and more common, unfortunately, now that the Broligarchy is in charge, there's a lot of talk about genetic primacy of certain people and the like. They only stay in the engineering classes. They don't come to the social sciences. Sorry about that. My school has trained too many engineers, trust me. But they've been running around saying, look, there's certain groups have genetic, you know, gifts, and they should be emphasized, whatever it might be. And this is all predicated on the idea that genes are simple, that they do simple things and they make you who you are quickly and immediately. You have a gene for something, you were born that way. It's not true when it comes to who you are in terms of personality. It takes too long to develop. There's too many things going on. Your temperament is not the same as what it is when you're an adult. So it can't be the case that you have genes that cause you at conception to be who you are. There has to be experiences and transactions. It's not to say that genetics is unimportant. It's probably like everything else. It has a small signal. It starts you out, and it's why parents notice their infants being different. But it's not the end of the story. And given this data, it should be disregarded because, again, that signal from where you were when you were a kid is really small. You have a lot to change between that time and when you're an adult. And so the idea that who you are is caused by your genes and that's the only thing you should care about is wrong from the beginning. Weirdly, the opposite is also true. Right? Right? You got to work with me here. I'm not here to make you happy. I'm here to lecture you, and that's my job. Right? So we have this obsession with childhood and what we do to kids, the high priority about how we should do things, and I'm not saying we shouldn't do things right with children. But there is also this notion that, and this is to absolve young parents of some of the guilt, that everything you do with your infant is going to be the end of the story. If you don't read that book to them, they will not get that IQ point that will get them into that school that you want them to get into, right? Every parent knows this pressure. And if the data are true that I showed you, that the relationship between what you're like when you're that young and what you're like when you're older has to relieve you of some of that responsibility and that guilt, right? Because what happens to children affects children at that time. But if what they're like at that time doesn't affect what they're like later, then it's not going to propagate forward, okay? So this is not to say that how we treat children is unimportant, but we should keep it in perspective. If anything, what this says is we should care about what happens to people, not just children, because the entirety of development is far more important than that. I hope I'm doing okay on time. I'll end with dough-related concluding thoughts. The other reason we come to Europe is to eat your bread. You think I'm joking. And you know bread comes in many forms. There's baguettes. Love a French baguette. Oh my gosh, right? Delectable. Crisp, light, a complement to everything, right? Simple. But not really complex. On the right, the German Vulcanbrot, sourdough version, right? Which is deeply complex, multifaceted, takes a long time to create. It has to proof for hours, if not days. And the result is an amazing melange and a wonderful, complex mouthfeel of bread, right? A lot of the stories we tell in the cultural narrative, in psychology, in social science, in the books that you see, are baguettes. Simple, crispy, a little bit empty, right? And in my opinion, the reality is that you, the people facing me here, you're Vulcanbrot. You've taken a long time to proof You started with a lot of different ingredients. You came together in a magical way, and you're not a simple bite, and you'll be memorable after consumed. Thank you for your time.
Danke, dass du diese Podcast-Episode gehört hast. Ich hoffe, sie hat dir gefallen und du konntest etwas Neues erfahren und lernen. Und wenn du schon mal da bist, lass uns doch eine Bewertung oder ein paar Sternchen da. Das würde uns sehr helfen. Und wenn du mehr Vorträge vom AHA-Festival hören willst, abonniere diesen Podcast und folge uns auf Instagram. Auch über Feedback freuen wir uns sehr. Schreib uns eine Mail an am@aha-festival.ch. AHA, ein Podcast für Wissen, ist eine Zusammenarbeit von Christoph Fellmann und mir, Anna Matijasiewicz. Mitproduziert und komponiert hat Nikola Miloš Mišić.